From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Israeli military said today it attacked nearly all of Iran's military installations inside Syria. Israel said the overnight missile strikes came in response to Iranian rockets launched toward Israeli military forces from inside Syria. Watchdog groups say Israel struck first. The White House condemned Iran's attacks. Russia said Israeli strikes mark a dangerous escalation in the region. Let's bring in the BBC defense and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus from London. And Jonathan, this is getting bigger play in the U.S. than recent other strikes because it's being seen as a result of President Trump's taking the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal and unleashing these heightened tensions. You say what?
Well, there are certainly heightened tensions in the region, but I think this has absolutely nothing to do with President Trump and his decision on the nuclear deal. What you have here is a sort of a long-term underlying cause and a short-term cause. The underlying cause is the growing strategic rivalry between Iran and Israel. Iran, which has strongly backed the Assad regime in Syria, with President Assad largely victorious, now finds itself trying to establish a permanent military presence in Syria, building up a military infrastructure. And of course, one of the advantages for the Iranians, is that it gives them, if you like, a direct front to confront Israel, which has been a long-standing enemy of the Iranian regime. The Israelis equally say that they are not prepared to accept this. They have done a number of strikes in the past to try and get that message home to the Iranians. Last night, of course, the Iranians, using this multiple launch rocket system, seem to have actually got their shots away. They fired some 20 short-range artillery rockets into, or at least in the direction of, the Israeli positions on the Golan Heights. And it was in response to that that the Israelis not only took out that particular multiple launch rocket system, but hit, we are told, some 70 targets across Syria. I was talking to the Israeli Defense Forces spokesman a short while ago. He said that these were Quds forces, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps forces. They weren't proxy militias or groups allied to Iran. They were the real McCoy, as it were. And the Israelis believe they have done some significant damage. They believe they've set back the building of this Iranian military infrastructure in Syria by some months, if not longer. And they think they've delivered a very strong message to Tehran.
Well, and you say that this is not a result of President Trump's announcement, but how has that announcement affected this, maybe even going forward? Has the U.S. kind of taken itself out of the mix as far as being a referee? Because we have Russia meeting with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday in Moscow. Russia, of course, Syrian President Assad's ally. Is Russia going to be the one to referee this?
Well, I think there's something in what you say. I'm not sure that the Russians particularly want to be the referee, but Russia, of course, is on the same side in Syria as Iran. They both back the Assad regime. I wouldn't see Russia's interests and Iran's interests being identical in any shape or form. And of course, what's fascinating about the relationship between Israel and Russia is that up to now, despite the fact that Russia has its own air force and air defenses inside Syria, it's a close ally of the Syrian regime, it's done absolutely nothing really to interfere with the Israeli Air Force's ability to use airspace over Syria and Lebanon to conduct its operations. One assumes that is likely to continue. In terms of America's role, I don't think America is likely to be a referee here. After all, the Trump administration has basically set its face strongly against the Iranian regime, insisting either that it must change its behavior, but I think many people feel that in the background of some people's minds in the administration, there is a desire fundamentally to change the regime in Iran. So I don't think America is likely to play a role as referee. Mr. Trump is clearly very much of a similar mind to that of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And of course, the curious thing is that, if you think back, we had the nuclear agreement because there were growing concerns that Israel, maybe with or, at least with the tacit support of America, might strike at Iranian nuclear targets. That was a real fear of a conflict, and it was those fears that were part of the reason that we got the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, in the first place. Now, in the absence of that deal, or at least with America having pulled out of it, I think it's done a number of things. One fundamental thing it's done is it's given a strong boost to the hardliners in Tehran, who don't trust the West, who certainly don't trust America, who are in the vanguard of the struggle against Israel. And as I say, it's those hardliners in the Revolutionary Guard Corps and so on, who are the people who actually control the Iranian military forces on the ground in Syria.
BBC defense and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus in London. Jonathan, thank you as always.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
President Trump's personal lawyer Michael Cohen wants to know how the lawyer for adult film actress Stormy Daniels got access to some of his bank records. Cohen's lawyer sent a letter to a federal judge yesterday saying Michael Avenatti's claims were inaccurate and that he may have obtained the records illegally. Avenatti says the records show that Michael Cohen likely committed bank fraud, something federal prosecutors are expected to look into in the ongoing investigation into Cohen's business practices. Here's Avenatti on MSNBC last night.
In my view, the most important questions right now are, where did that money go? And Michael Cohen and Mr. Ryan, they can clear all of this up. All they have to do is submit the bank statements, provide the bank statements on this account.
Alex Little is a former federal prosecutor. He's now a defense lawyer at Bone McAllister Norton in Nashville. Alex, let's start with what bank fraud is.
Yeah, bank fraud is a statute, a federal statute that protects banks from sort of the misdeeds of potential customers. Generally, it involves lying to a bank about something material that they care about and getting money as a result.
And the issue here is that Michael Cohen may have lied about his own assets in order to get a line of credit.
That's exactly right. And that's the thing that banks are most concerned about, is when you tell them I've got a certain amount of money and the bank says, okay, well, I'll give you some more. They do that in part based on the assets you already have. So if you don't repay your loan, they'll be able to come after and get those other assets.
In this case, Cohen said the account was used for a real estate consulting firm. Avenatti, the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, says this firm was just a conduit for payments like the one made to Stormy Daniels to keep her quiet about an alleged affair with Donald Trump. Is it hard to prove bank fraud? What's the legal standard?
Well, a legal standard for anything at trial is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the concern here about the bank fraud is there's no clear evidence that the bank lost money. It does appear the bank was misled potentially about what the use of this account was. But if the bank didn't lose money as a result, you've got a question about whether or not there's a loss here or even an intended loss.
And would the bank have to want to press charges in this case, or could prosecutors go after Cohen for bank fraud even if the bank said this is not a big deal to us?
Sure. No, the prosecutors could always go after a defendant, whether or not the victim has any intent of going after them.
So what do you think will happen here?
Well, I think this is really a piece of a larger puzzle. And the question that's raised more in my mind than bank fraud is whether there's some money laundering going on. When you lie to a bank, you can do that for lots of different reasons. And in cases you investigate sort of in the white collar sphere, the biggest question is why would someone mislead a bank? And if there's other money coming in and out of an account, that sounds more like money laundering than bank fraud.
Do you see evidence here of money laundering?
Certainly. When you name an account one thing, talk about it's being used for one purpose and plainly use it for another, I think that's going to give investigators definitely a lead to follow.
In the case of bank fraud, what's the penalty for it?
Up to 10 years in jail. Generally, that's the maximum penalty, and the actual penalty would be less depending on the amount of money at issue.
There are also some questions about how Cohen nearly doubled his credit line in February of 2016. What more do we know about that, or do you think it's relevant?
Well, I do think it's relevant. The question is, why did he double it at that time? If you recall, that was during the height of the campaign, the primary campaign. President Trump was being attacked by his rivals on the Republican side. And so we know that at least some of the money that came out of that account was used to pay, or appears to be used to pay, Stormy Daniels as hush money. And the question it might raise is whether or not that whole account was used for that purpose of protecting President Trump during the campaign with these sort of illegal uses.
What do you make of the fact that Avenatti has put his interpretation of Cohen's bank records out there this week during the federal investigation into Michael Cohen? If Avenatti did get the records illegally, what would that mean?
I doubt he got them illegally. There's a lot. I mean, it'd be pretty difficult to get them illegally unless he went in and stole them from the bank himself. Someone gives you something. Someone else may have done something wrong, but there's no real evidence that Avenatti did. But I think he's trying to play a larger game. His case is, you know, one piece of this larger puzzle. I think he and his client probably understand that, and their goals are likely much larger than just winning his small case.
Do you think at this point that Cohen did anything illegal based on what we know so far?
He certainly has acted like it. And I think, you know, when the FBI, particularly Southern District of New York, comes after you with a search warrant at your house and collects your legal papers as a lawyer, they certainly believe there's something going on. And some of the evidence that's come out in these reports about transactions and the way they've been misleading, I certainly think he's going to find himself in some big trouble.
And what about President Trump? Would he be implicated? Let's say that, for example, AT&T, which we know put money into this account, that AT&T did that in order to influence President Trump.
Yeah, that would be a pretty shocking accusation if it's proven. And to prove it, I think you'd have to get Michael Cohen to flip on President Trump and tell the prosecutors that essentially that's what happened. Because there's going to need to be some evidence that President Trump did something or intended to do something as a result of that money. And so far, there's no reporting that that's the case.
And do you think that prosecutors are going after Michael Cohen right now just to get him to flip on President Trump?
No, I think that the folks in that office in Southern District of New York believe what they're doing. They are following the law where it takes them. And whether or not it leads to President Trump, they certainly are going to see if they can make a case against Michael Cohen. And I expect they will.
That's Alex Little, who's a former federal prosecutor, now with the firm Bone McAllister Norton in Nashville. Alex, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And it's graduation season, an annual walk across the stage that many graduates assume they will make. For others, it's a miracle. Rosie Beth Cuevas will soon become the first person in her family to graduate from college. But that's not the miracle. 4 years ago, Rosie Beth was a senior at Manuel Arts High School in South Los Angeles. She dreamed of college in rural Northern California at Humboldt State University and joined others who'd be first-generation college students on a 12-hour bus trip on April 10th, 2014, when a FedEx truck crossed the divider and hit the bus in a fiery explosion.
911 emergency, what are you reporting?
Hi, I was in a car accident. I was on a travel bus, and we crashed into a FedEx truck or
something. 10 died in the fireball, including both drivers, 2 newly engaged chaperones, an admissions counselor, and 5 students. Here's former HSU President Roland Richman speaking at a vigil on campus a week later.
On April 10th, we lost a group of bright young people with promising futures, and many would have been the first in their families to attend college. They were all taking the right steps to ensure a better future when their lives were critically cut short. And others on that trip were doing
Rosie Beth Cuevas survived, and this weekend she'll finish the journey she started that day. She joins us now. It is a tender, tender topic, and Rosie Beth, while we offer congratulations, we're aware this is a bittersweet time.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, we know you've been in touch with the families of some of those who died. One of the students was Ishmael Jimenez of Inglewood, California. He was called a hero that day, helped other students get out but didn't make it. And we have Ishmael's sister here, Evelyn Jimenez. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, well, this has got to be a bittersweet day for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we know you've been in touch with the students who are graduating on Facebook, so we want to ask you about that. And you do want to talk now because of your thoughts about these kids that are doing what your brother could not do. So let's meet one of them. Rosie Beth, a criminology and justice studies major with a minor in political science, graduating with highest honors. How did that day 4 years ago change you, maybe propel you forward to this day?
You know, I wish I can say that it actually changed the way that I saw life automatically, but it was actually really hard. I suffered a lot of survivor's guilt. It was honestly really hard to appreciate the second chance that I was given. And just from that, it was just throughout 4 years that I was here, it's been really hard.
Well, and not just the emotional difficulty, but you had awful injuries to your spine, your neck, your right ankle, your right wrist. You had fractured teeth. You had several surgeries. You know, you barely made it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone on this bus was part of a spring preview program at Humboldt State University, part of the California school system. It began in 1989 as a way to help low-income and first-generation college students check out the school. Do you mind if we just take you back to just, you know, who was on that bus? We don't want to have any triggers here.
That's fine.
Okay. What was the spirit on that bus?
We were all really excited, actually, and we were getting to know each other. I was the only one from my high school who was actually on the bus, but I got to meet a lot of the people that I was sitting next to. We were playing music, just singing along, getting to know each other, the chaperones. Micah, one of the chaperones, was in the back of the bus with us for a really long time, telling us about his experience at HSU, and it was really fun, and yeah.
Did that counselor make it?
No. Michael was actually one of the he was the one that was engaged.
Oh, just it's just a horror. And HSU tells us that 26 of the survivors of the crash were awarded scholarships to go to school. Of those 26, six, including you, Rosie Beth, are graduating this weekend. Others are still enrolled, but they're going to graduate later. Do you talk to each other? I mean, do you all have that sense of guilt, or is there something that joins you together that has helped you get through the years?
I don't keep in touch with everyone, but the ones that I do keep in touch have expressed the same feeling. And yeah, it's just, I feel like a lot of them disassociated from the group. Just, I don't know, maybe it was just the way of overcoming it.
Yeah.
But I do feel like a lot of the other students said that they suffered from survivor's guilt.
Let's bring in Evelyn Jimenez. Again, she's the sister of Ismael Jimenez, who died on the bus after heroically opening a window or cracking open a window and getting others out, them being overcome. Evelyn, how have you made it through the last 4 years?
It's been difficult, but I had to be the strength for my parents and my little brother.
Yeah. We understand. I mean, this is not uncommon. Your parents divorced after the crash. It feels like it took a toll.
Yeah. Everything definitely changed. My brother used to be the one who tried to keep us together. I know he wanted to go to college just to be able to help my mom and my dad a little more.
Yeah. Would he have been the first in the family to go?
Yes.
Well, and this is just unbearable. But his friend, Denise Gomez, also died in the crash. They're buried next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Evelyn, we want to celebrate their spirit as well. You know, tell us about them. They were homecoming king and queen.
Yeah. They weren't together, boyfriend and girlfriend. They were really just best friends. So they've known each other since they were in sixth grade. I know it would have been very hard for my brother if he would have made it and known that his best friend did not. So I know that for some reason it had to happen the way it happened.
Mm.
I'm sure he would feel that guilt that they feel.
Yeah. I think it's hard to underscore what happens to a family when the one that was going to be the first to go to college or, you know, get on that kind of a path doesn't.
Yeah.
And I know you were a makeup artist, but you just sort of gave up, but picked up your brushes again?
Yeah. A year later, I had a dream of my brother telling me to pick up my brushes because he knew how good I was. Sorry.
It's okay.
For the first year, I had many dreams of pretty much me being in that bus and trying to save him.
Yeah.
But a year later, I ended up picking up my brushes and I haven't stopped. I have my makeup business called Eve's Beauty Canvas because he used to call me his canvas. A canvas that was going to grow up to know what I was going to do because I was pretty lost at that time when he was in high school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So after I had that dream, it definitely helped me a lot.
So he continued to inspire you after death, even if he didn't go to school.
Yes, he definitely did.
Evelyn Jimenez, I want to bring Rosie Beth Cuevas back in. And Evelyn, you heard Rosie Beth say she had survivor's guilt, you know, because people like your brother didn't make it. You've been on Facebook. You've been in touch with these survivors. What would you say to them? What would you say to her?
I don't want them to feel any kind of guilt because God had a reason of why he chose those 10 people to go. And there was a big reason of why these 26 group of people still made it.
Rosie Beth, I don't imagine that takes away your... Because you have spoken to Evelyn.
Yeah.
But does it help a little?
It does. It just, throughout college, part of, besides my family, it's them that, like, kept me going. It was always in the back of my head whenever I just wanted to give up, I just constantly thought of them. I thought of their families. And I thought about how I still get the opportunity to be the first in my college and do what their families wanted to see in them. And that's I hope that their families can see that in me. I don't feel like some sense of accomplishment because I survived and I was able to do these things. And I just
don't feel guilty. You know, I wish it was my brother and Denise as well, you know, but to me, I love to see these, you know, I hate calling them the survivor kids, but for these years, I love seeing how they continued. They still keep my brother and the rest of the four kids that passed away in mind of why they need to continue. I mean, it's honestly a blessing to hear that.
Well, you have both given such a gift of grace to us. Evelyn Jimenez, her brother Ishmael Jimenez, one of 10 killed on a bus trip to visit Humboldt State University in 2014. Rosie Beth Cuevas, one of those who survived that crash and is graduating from Humboldt State University this weekend. Thank you both so much.
No problem.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is the best time of the season for NBA fans, especially for fans of the teams that are now in the conference finals. In the East, the Cleveland Cavaliers will play the Boston Celtics, and in the West, the defending champions, the Golden State Warriors, take on the Houston Rockets. Each is a 7-game series. The winners will meet in the NBA finals. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us. Mike, start with the East. This is a rematch of last season's conference finals, which was won by Cleveland. What will you be watching for?
Well, it's a totally different matchup in a way because Kyrie Irving was traded from the Cavaliers to the Celtics, right. And the Celtics were possibly the favorite going into the season. Game one of the season, Gordon Hayward goes down with a season-ending injury. So after game one, if you would ask me, will the Celtics make the finals, I would say, or the conference finals, I'd have said no. But then they're great. But with game maybe 80 of the season, if you ask me the same question, I'd say no, because Kyrie Irving got hurt again. But somehow the Celtics, with their great coach, Brad Stevens, are a team that absolutely deserves to be there, and they're playing the Cleveland Cavaliers. They have this guy named LeBron James. He's quite good. In fact, every year he shows he's possibly better than we even thought he was. I really don't think it's too far-fetched to say he's the greatest basketball player who's ever lived at this point.
But he's carrying the team right now, the Cavaliers.
He's more than carrying the team. This is the worst collection of teammates that LeBron has ever gone into the playoffs with, and he won in 7 games in round 2 and decimated the Toronto Raptors, which were the best team in the East. Decimated them. The playoff roster that they're playing with includes some players who came back from injury and that they recently traded for. That seems to be gelling more. But the gap between LeBron and the second best player on his team is the biggest gap that we've ever seen from a LeBron James team.
And what about in the West, the Warriors and the Rockets?
So the Warriors, the champions last year, and the question was, can anyone beat them? And the answer is perhaps injury or perhaps the Rockets themselves. The Warriors are so laden with talent, but Steph Curry got hurt. He wasn't even available in the first round of the playoffs, but now he's available and now he's doing great. So going into this series, I think before the playoffs, you would have said that the Rockets would have been favored. I think that the Warriors, by dint of experience and talent, you would say that the Warriors have the edge.
And just real quick, what happened to the 76ers, the Philadelphia 76ers, who were supposed to do much better after a multi-year drought that gave them the opportunity to get some great new players?
Well, I thought they did well. I thought they did really well. There was a lot of hype and hope with them going into the playoffs. They were great in the first round, even though they didn't take the Celtics to 7. I thought they showed that if you had to bet on the future, Sixers stock should be the most expensive in the East.
Okay, what about the NHL playoffs? Yes. Mike, Nashville and Winnipeg have Game 7 tonight. The winner plays Las Vegas in the Western Conference Final. Tampa Bay and Washington play for the Eastern Championship. What are you watching for?
If Nashville wins, think about for the Final Four, Washington, Nashville, Tampa Bay, and Las Vegas. Now, I know Tampa Bay and Las Vegas, no ice there. Nashville can get ice, but these aren't natural hockey cities. The Capitals should be, or Washington should be, but, you know, no Washington team has gone this far in the playoffs for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. The Capitals finally make it to a conference final. The real story of hockey has been these Las Vegas Knights. It's their right. First year. They've made it thus far, and they're actually the favorite to make it to the Stanley Cup Finals out of the West.
Mike Pesca, Here Now Sports Analyst. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, time now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Aaron Bird is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, and he's back with us once again. Aaron, great to have you back. Welcome.
It's great to be back, man. Thanks again. It's, I guess, even though we're in May, a Happy New Year is due. I haven't been on since 2017.
I haven't said Happy New Year to anybody in a long time, so good. You remind us. It is 2018 now. And what are we going to be listening to today?
Several songs that I'm really excited about, including a couple of artists that I think are just breakout acts that we'll be hearing a lot from in the coming years.
All right, well, let's listen to the first one. This is the song Slippin'. It's by the duo Wahada.
I know that there's someone. I feel like there's something. I know that you want to. But say it is hard for you.
Now, Wahada is made up of DJ John Tejada and the musician-comedian Reggie Watts, who's also the band leader on The Late Late Show with James Corden.
That's right. Many people are familiar with Reggie Watts nowadays because of his exposure on The Late Night Show. John Tejada, he's been around in the electronic dance music scene for over 20 years. He's probably best known for his work in the techno world. And this isn't an obvious combination, as I would imagine, for most. But the first two offerings, which include the first single Running and the song we just heard Slipping, I think leaves whatever people may question to rest, because it is fantastic.
And the album comes out on Comedy Dynamics Records. Is this a comedy project?
No, not at all. It's a serious music project. I mean, I think at the time when people first hear of the collaboration, it may make them chuckle and laugh, but no, it's a serious music endeavor.
All right, well, next we have the LA-based musician Duckworth with Boy.
See, I'm a boy, boy, boy. And you're a girl, girl, girl. See, you're a boy, boy, boy. And I'm a girl, girl, girl.
Wait!
Let's be
second. I wanna hear that beat, your heart is bumping, girl, your essence is something like the pinkest sky. Grab them puffy cows and cover them when hippie color dye. Purple rain, ain't that insane? I bet you seen that coming like a million miles away.
That's real.
I wear my beanie in the winter just like Marvin Gaye.
Now, Duckworth is the stage name for Jared Lee, who's a rapper and singer. He also went to school for graphic design. Tell us about him.
So he likes to describe himself as ugly, but he doesn't mean it in the traditional sense. It has nothing to do with vanity. Rather, it's sort of this unabashed acceptance and deep appreciation of all the unconventional qualities that make him unique. And no better example of this than this song, Boy.
Hmm. And according to Pitchfork, he longs to be the next hip-hop iconoclast. What do you make of that?
Oh, I had not known that. But it makes a lot of sense. I think one word that I would use to describe Duckworth's creative endeavors would be ambitious. So that makes sense.
Hmm. All right, well, let's get to the next song. This is CRV. It's by Kuko.
I look like a mom in my CRV. Flex it on your friends in my CRV. Got like five seats in my CRV for my whole crew in my CRV. Got my whole gang in my CRV. Got the groceries in my CRV. I got no game in my CRV. I'm so average in my CRV. Riding down the street in my CRV. Picking up my homies in my CRV. Kick it with my boo thing in my CRV. Riding down the street in my Honda SUV.
He's talking there about a Honda CRV, not a Bentley or, you know, not a Benz, but rolling down the street in a Honda CRV.
Yes, exactly. I'm glad you find the humor in this just as much as I do.
Now, this is not the first time that we have heard from Kuko on the DJ sessions. Your colleague, Jose Galvan, brought him to us before. What do you like about him?
I like his dedication to being exactly who he is, which is a 19-year-old kid. I mean, he sings both in English and Spanish. I should mention he's a local guy. He's from Hawthorne, California, which is essentially South L.A. And he makes really heavy synth-based ballads about his life and the life of a teenage boy. You know, he sings about desires, insecurities, puppy love, crushes. Yeah, he's a teenage boy and also will sometimes make a song about a Honda CRV.
Okay, well, up next, let's see if we've got another car song here, but I don't think so. Yellow Days, this is The Way Things Change.
I can't hear any words to say. I swear I must have lost the friend. Well, my friends think my soul is dead.
Thanks.
But I'm just trapped in my
quite a voice.
I know, yeah. If King Krewell and Leon Bridges had a baby, it would be Yellow Days. Yeah, I've been a big, big fan of this cat since he first came onto the scene a couple of years ago at the ripe old age of 17. He's now 19 and came out with one of the best albums of 2017 last fall called Is Everything Okay in Your World? And in fact, you know, if it hadn't come out so late in the year, I'm sure it would have made plenty of top 10 lists.
Wow, two 19-year-olds in the same segment. Well done. Well done, 19-year-olds. You guys are doing good.
There's hope in the youth, right?
I guess so. All right, for the last one, we've got the singer-violinist Sudan Archives and her song, Not For Sale.
You only call me when you need something. I need to be free. Time to spread my wings. I don't like leeches. All that nonsense gon' get back with ya. Don't got time for snitches. You're pulling me down, but you was my sister. My strings propagate.
navigate through space and time, here and there at the same time. Hand dimensions and basic rhyme, you ain't gotta be mad. Look deep and go higher when you climb, but stay out of my path, but stay out of my flight path. Never feeling lonely, only gliding.
Now, Sudan Archives is actually Cincinnati-born Brittany Denise Parks. Is there Sudanese influence in here?
Yes, there is. So over the last few years, there's been this emergence of avant-garde sort of orchestral polymaths. And most recent to enter this scene is Sudan Archives. I also like to point out that all of these acts are black women, which is quite impressive and I think is worth drawing attention to. And her specific weapon of choice is the violin. Her mother gave her the nickname Sudan when she was little. And she's described herself as just sort of this naturally inquisitive kid. So naturally, with the name Sudan, she began researching and studying Sudanese fiddlers and other forms of music from Northeast Africa. Hmm. And that's where you hear her influence.
And the song is called Not For Sale, N-O-N-T. Do you know why that is and why it's not for sale?
Simply because she saw it on a sign on a trip to Ghana. Yeah. And so she talks about being worth something, to bring something to the table. She's just not that easy to get. She's not for sale.
That's Aaron Bird, a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica. Aaron, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to hear from you.
Don't wait for me, son.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
This week, a white female grad student at Yale confronted a black woman sleeping in the common room of a dorm and told her she couldn't sleep there. The black woman explained that she was also a grad student who'd fallen asleep, but still, the white woman called the police, and Lolade Sinyobula again had to explain to them she lived there.
That's fine.
I need to go back to the 12th floor to finish writing my paper.
You got your ID on you?
Yeah, I do.
All right, can we see that?
Why?
We got a police call for you.
Okay, let me open my apartment for you so that you can see that I belong here.
This is the latest example of whites calling the police on blacks doing ordinary things, from golfing to three black teens prom shopping and wrongly suspected of shoplifting at a Nordstrom Rack in Missouri, to three black women, including Bob Marley's granddaughter, leaving an Airbnb. According to Yale, the campus police eventually admonished the white student who'd made her call. Erin Wack is national writer on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. And Erin, of course, there was a rash of stories of police excessive use of force against unarmed black men. But is there a sense in these 911 calls that, except maybe for those young men waiting for a meeting at Starbucks who were handcuffed after workers called, that police are being called in and seeing ultimately these calls are frivolous?
Right. In all of these cases, it's the 911 call that really escalates these encounters. And, you know, that's led to some criticism that some people really have just become too quick to call 911 for really non-emergencies, even though, you know, the catalyst for many people is that they say that they feel threatened. And where that presents a problem, you mentioned the white graduate student being admonished, but that was after you had the black graduate student have to prove to police that she actually did belong there because 911 had been called. And in most of these cases, the onus is on the black person who has had the police called on them to prove that they are, in fact, not a threat.
Well, we also saw earlier this week the young black women who were checking out of their Airbnb rental in California, and suddenly police cars surround them because one of the white neighbors was suspicious of black women who, she said, didn't seem friendly being in the neighborhood.
Right.
The owner of that house with the rooms that were rented said she doesn't really blame her neighbor. Maybe she should have told her she had rentals there. Of course, she probably wants to be able to keep the rentals. But what's the conversation in the black community? What kind of comments are you getting?
So Airbnb has had issues around racial bias prior to this incident. You know, there were issues of racial profiling, which the company has attempted to address to create a more welcoming and inclusive environment for both people who are renting and for people who are renting to others. And so that was something that they, you know, have been in the midst of addressing when this incident occurs. And the police camera video shows this neighbor who had called 911 kind of explaining her reasoning, saying, you know, that while this group of women had luggage in their hands, they weren't making eye contact with her and they weren't behaving like neighbors. And so she said that she wasn't being nosy, but she was being observant. But obviously, you know, we now know that these folks were just simply attempting to check out of that Airbnb.
Well, you're the race reporter, but I would think the question at the heart of this is, would any of these incidents have happened? Would any of these calls to 911 have been made if somebody had fallen asleep in the common room and was white, or if somebody was leaving an Airbnb and was white?
That's a good question. I mean, even, you know, with this Airbnb situation, the group and police were discussing whether or not it was actually racially motivated. So there is, you know, a question, you know, is this really racism? But I think that given the headlines that we've seen recently, what we're talking about are interactions that are involving black people in this country. And so we're not really seeing, you know, a proliferation of headlines around white people having to explain to police why they are in certain spaces that they, you know, have a right to be in.
Do you think, and I'm wondering if maybe readers who respond to your stories think, that this is because this is on social media, so we're seeing what's always been going on, or there's maybe a spike of these incidents now?
Well, yes, readers are definitely, you know, saying that social media is playing a role, because, of course, we know that these sorts of interactions aren't new. And what is new is the rise of social media, including, you know, the use of Facebook Live and Twitter, for example. And what that does is both prove that these interactions are happening, and then it also helps to amplify the outrage beyond that incident and beyond, you know, that one community to really demand accountability and action for what has happened. You know, if these incidents in the past were rising to the level of say, national news, this is something that would have taken far longer to happen. And in the cases where this is happening, you know, at businesses, companies may not have necessarily felt the same compulsion to respond. And what I would also add to that is that cell phones, while they have, you know, had an effect in terms of the social media, they've also made it easier for people to call 911. Cell phones are the main way that people use, you know, to call the police now.
Erin Wack, race reporter at the Associated Press. Erin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So your thoughts, your experiences, we'd love to hear them. Are you thinking maybe you are too quick to reach for your cell phone? Have you been the one called on? Your thoughts, herenow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.